Bertrand L. Comparé.
Tonight I want to talk about the tribe of Benjamin and what happened to them eventually. As you know, the entire 12 tribes were born of four different mothers, so they were not all full brothers. However, Joseph and Benjamin were full brothers, born of the same mother, Rachel. Benjamin's destiny appeared odd from the beginning. He was always, of course, a great favorite of his father, Jacob. And in Genesis 49, verse 27, when the aged Israel is on his deathbed in Egypt, and he's giving to each of his children his blessing, he says this about Benjamin. Benjamin shall raven as a wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall divide the spoil. Now that warlike blessing seemed a little bit odd, because at all times Benjamin was one of the smallest tribes in Israel. In the first chapter of Numbers, you note that the tribe of Benjamin had 35,400 warriors, and only one tribe, Manasseh, with 32,200, was smaller. The discrepancy became greater through the centuries as they went on to become a nation in their promised land. So here one of the smallest tribes yet had a warlike destiny. Moses, when he was reaching the end of his life and was telling the tribes what would become of them, in Deuteronomy 33, verse 12, Moses said of Benjamin, "The beloved of Yahweh shall dwell in safety by him, and Yahweh shall cover him all the day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders." Some of the translations say, "Yahweh will carry him in his bosom." So anyway, there was a very special destiny for this small tribe of Benjamin. During the Exodus, when the people of Israel were on the march, as they set up their camp at night, they camped in the form of a hollow square. And on the west were three tribes. There are three tribes on each of the four sides, and on the west, these three were Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. Ephraim was the leading tribe, and their banner flew to show where the headquarters was on the western side. But we might well expect, therefore, that the final gathering in of the tribes and their ultimate homeland might be in somewhat that same order. When they settled in Palestine, Benjamin had a narrow strip of territory between Judah on the south of them, Ephraim and Manasseh on the north of them, Dan on the west, and Reuben across the Jordan River to the east of them. And the city of Jerusalem lay right on the border between Benjamin and Judah. Well, they had a rather checkered career there. As the reading of the historical books of the Bible will show you, none of the tribes of Israel behaved themselves properly much of the time. They had their wicked men among them, and because then as now, it was always somebody else's business to curb the wicked. "Don't disturb me with it. I'm too busy making money. Let somebody else take care of that." So the wicked flourished and became powerful and dangerous. It appears most particularly in Benjamin, in one incident which is told in the last three chapters of the book of Judges, Judges 19, 20, and 21. A Levite had married a woman whose parents lived in Jerusalem and had taken her to his home city some distance away. She misbehaved herself very badly, was an adulteress, and finally left him and went home to her parents. And instead of offering up a prayer of thanksgiving to God for that, he went back to her parents' home to get her and take her back again. He stayed several days at the parents' home and then left late in the afternoon, which was always a mistake. Now, the larger cities generally had an inn where travelers could stay. The smaller towns did not. So they got just a few miles out of town to a little village within the territory of Benjamin, stopped for the night. An old man, evidently living alone, had no sons to defend his home, offered him hospitality for the night, so he and his wife went in there. Now, of course, in a little town, the arrival of a stranger is always the subject of local gossip, was then. So during the night, some of the ruffians of the town came and threatened to break in the door and kill the old man and his guest unless they were able to get at this Levite's wife. So to save their lives, they pushed her out of the door into the street, and this gang of ruffians gang raped her all night until she died from her injuries. You remember that the Bible definitely commands the death penalty for a large number of crimes, and during those times when they enforced the law, why, crime just about disappeared. When the criminal disappears, so does crime. Well, the Levite cut up the corpse of his wife into a dozen pieces and sent a piece to the headquarters of each of the 12 tribes. That was something startling enough to cause them to ask questions. How could all this be? What had happened? So when the news got out, there was general indignation, and they demanded of the people of this village that they hand over the criminals for trial and, of course, execution. They refused to do it. And the other tribes then called up their military forces, and the whole 11 of them declared war on Benjamin. Well, it would have been much better for Benjamin to have handed over the criminals. So that's how it worked out. There was warfare between the one little tribe of Benjamin and the entire other 11 tribes of Israel. And indeed, for the first few days, Benjamin gave him a thorough whipping. Remember, Benjamin shall raven as a wolf, and he was starting to live up to that original prophecy. Nevertheless, the armies that outweighed them so much, outnumbered them so much, prevailed. And they had sworn, when Benjamin offered resistance, that they were going to absolutely exterminate the tribe of Benjamin. And with the exception of a group of about 600 of the warriors, who finally were able to flee away from the battlefield, the armies of Israel did just that. Every village they took, they slaughtered the aged and the women and the children and everybody. And then it finally dawned on them what they had accomplished in practically exterminating one of the 12 tribes. Now, they had also sworn, first of all, anyone of military age who did not come join the army for the war against Benjamin would be killed. Secondly, any man who gave his daughter in marriage to a Benjamite would be killed. Well, they had killed all but 600 of them who fled out into the wilderness. Now what? Then they began to sit down and weep and tear their hair and so on, because now the tribes were down to 11. No more Benjamin. What to do? Well, they finally found that there was one village from which no man had come to join the army of Israel to fight against Benjamin. Well, that offered a first idea. They were a pretty bloodthirsty lot in those days. They went to this village and they slaughtered its inhabitants, with the exception that they found 400 young women of marriageable age and unmarried. They saved those alive and cut the throats of the rest of them. So they sent messengers out to where the Benjamites had found a place where they could fight for their lives, finally, out in the wilderness. And they said, well, it's all over. We aren't mad anymore. And we have gotten 400 women here for you for wives. But there were 600 of these warriors. Problem still wasn't solved. But with the typical ancient Oriental ideas, they had a scheme for that. They didn't want to violate their oath, that nobody would voluntarily give his daughter as a wife to a Benjamite. But they said, well, there's a city not far away from here, pretty good size, and in the next few days, they're going to have a festival. And as part of the celebration, they come out in the fields and dance and sing and so on. Now, the 200 of you who have no wives, you go hide in the brush at the edge of that field. And when you see the young women from this village out there dancing and singing in the field in their celebration, why, you rush in and kidnap some wives, which they did. Of course, the parents whose daughters had been kidnapped felt a bit annoyed at that, but the rest of Israel calmed them down, explained why they had to do this, because nobody wanted to violate his oath and particularly get his throat cut for it. So finally, everybody was happy except the much greater part of the tribe of Benjamin that had been massacred. Well, that was rough treatment, but it did serve to purge the tribe. Now, on something of this sort, you may be sure that God had a hand in it. If the tribe was going to be almost exterminated, he would be on hand to see that the better ones were the ones who survived, and that the worst of them would be among those who perished on the battlefield. So, from this time on, evidently, they were a much better influence. In the sixth chapter of Jeremiah, Jeremiah 6, verse 1, with no particular reason for it, apparent at the time, the prophet Jeremiah gives a special warning to the tribe of Benjamin, singling them out by name. O you children of Benjamin, gather yourselves to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem, and blow the trumpet in Tekoa, and set up a sign of fire in Beth-Hakerem. For calamity appears out of the north, and great destruction. Well, the time for that was still in the indefinite future. But there was a time when the point of it became apparent, as we shall see. You remember that the first invasion and conquest came to the northern kingdom of Israel. Between 740 and 721 B.C., all those being years of constant fighting, the vast armies of Assyria gradually conquered all of the northern kingdom and deported their men and settled them in what came later to be called Scythia, around the southern end of the Caspian Sea. Now, the geography of Palestine is worthy of note here for a moment. If you set it down in Southern California, it would extend from the Mexican border to the southerly part of Los Angeles. And inland from the sea, it wouldn't be wider than 40 miles at any point. Now divide that into three roughly equal portions. The southerly third was that of the entire kingdom of Judah, made up of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. The northerly two-thirds of that area was that of the ten-tribed kingdom of Israel. When the Assyrians conquered it, the Bible is very careful to point out that the southerly part of the territory of Israel, the middle third of the entire Palestinian area, Samaria, was the one that they repopulated with other people. The northerly portion, Galilee, they left vacant. You find it in 2 Kings 17, verse 24. And the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, and from Cusa, and from Ava, and from Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. So now, of these three portions of Palestine, the southerly third was still occupied by the kingdom of Judah. The middle third was occupied by the people that the Assyrians had settled there in place of the deported Israelites, and the northerly third, Galilee, was left vacant. A bit over a century later, Babylon conquered the southern kingdom of Judah and deported them for 70 years to the territory right around Babylon. While they were gone, the Edomites, a most pestilential people from their beginning, the Edomites were driven out of their territory up to that time, Mount Seir, a very rugged mountain range southeast of the Dead Sea. They were driven out by an invasion of an Arabian people, the Nabateans. And they couldn't go southwest. That would take them into the territory of Egypt, and they weren't big enough to pick any quarrel with Egypt. If they went straight west into the southerly portion of the vacant territory which Judah had occupied, there were very few people left there, so no resistance could be made. And they did settle there. Well, now remember, the entire territory of the southerly kingdom of Judah wasn't more than perhaps 40 miles from north to south. And the southerly half of that was now taken up by the Edomites. So when the little group came back from Babylon, some Benjamites, some Judahites, and some mongrel mixture, and some Babylonians, they didn't have much land in which to spread out. Remember, originally, the territory of the tribe of Judah had been on the south and the territory of the tribe of Benjamin on the north. So they sorted themselves out in roughly that same order. Some few Benjamites were able to stay in the old territory of Judea, but the bulk of them were pushed out. Now, they couldn't just move back one step into Samaria. That was thoroughly occupied. They had to leapfrog over into Galilee, up in the north, around the Sea of Galilee, because that was vacant. So in Jesus Christ's time, Galilee was populated almost exclusively by Benjamites. Judea and the capital city of Jerusalem had some, not many out of the relatively big population total, some Judahites, a little handful of Benjamites, a lot of Edomites, and a general mixture of the Canaanites of the vicinity, which the people of Israel had been commanded by God to exterminate, and they failed to do it. Then, of course, since Palestine was then, even more than now, the crossroads of the world, you had, of course, some mixture of Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, Syrians, Babylonians, and whatever came along. Now, Jesus Christ's hometown, Nazareth, was in Galilee. It was just north of the valley of Megiddo, where there is yet to be a great battle. It was a few miles southwest of the Sea of Galilee. Now, you remember that he made most of his converts up in Galilee. Bible in one place says he could not walk in Jewry, for the Jews sought to kill him. So he went back home to Galilee. Another one, Matthew 13, verses 53 to 54. And it came to pass that when Jesus had finished these parables, he departed thence. And when he was come into his own country, you know, they recognized Galilee as his own country, he taught them in their synagogue, insomuch that they were astonished and said, "Whence hath this man this wisdom and these mighty works?" To what extent any of this was a hangover from the old days, I don't know. But the Galileans, the Benjamites up there, developed a distinctive dialect of their own. Now, they were speaking Aramaic, but they spoke it with an accent of their own. You have no difficulty in recognizing a Cockney Englishman by his speech. And similarly, they had no difficulty at all in recognizing a Galilean. Always there had been a difference in accent or dialect between the northern kingdom and the southern one. You remember in Judges 12, verses 5 and 6, Ephraim had invaded the territory below it and been thoroughly licked in the resulting battle. They'd attacked the city of Gilead, and the army of Gilead, trying to catch the stragglers, seized the fords over the River Jordan. And this says, "And the Gileadites took the passages of Jordan before the Ephraimites. And it was so that when those Ephraimites which were escaped said, 'Let me go over,' that the men of Gilead said unto him, 'Art thou an Ephraimite?' If he said, 'Nay,' then said they unto him, 'Now say Shibboleth,'" word that meant a stream. "And he said Shibboleth," for he could not frame to pronounce it right. In other words, the same letter that was pronounced like the letter F in the northern kingdom of Israel was pronounced like SH in the kingdom of Judah. Now, with one exception, all of Jesus Christ's disciples were Galileans, Benjamites. The only exception was Judas, who betrayed him. All the Bible names are badly mangled in trying to transliterate them into Greek in the New Testament. You note when you read it, it never speaks of the prophet Jeremiah. It calls him Jeremy, or I think in one place Jeremiah with an S on the end of it instead of an H. And Isaiah becomes Isaiah and so forth. Well, there is no such word in any language known to mankind as Iscariot. That was garbled up. Judas Iscariot. Judas, or Judah, the man of Kerioth. Kerioth was a little village down in the southwestern portion of the old territory of Judah, by then occupied by the Edomites. So Judas was an Edomite Jew, and he was the only Jew among the apostles. And, of course, he behaved like it. You remember that when Jesus was arrested the night of his betrayal and taken to the home of the high priest, and Peter followed him. And he pretty near got into difficulties himself, because as a Galilean, he spoke with that accent. Luke 22, verse 59. "And about the space of 1 hour after, another confidently affirmed, saying, 'Of a truth, this fellow was with him, for he is a Galilean.'" They could recognize him. Mark 14, verse 70. "And he denied it again. And a little after, they that stood by said again to Peter, 'Surely thou art one of them, for thou art a Galilean, and thy speech agreeth thereto.'" And you find it noted again at the day of Pentecost, Acts 2, chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. "And when the day of Pentecost was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place." Now, by now, Judas Iscariot was dead. But the other 11 apostles were there, and they had also chosen a man to take the place of Judas. And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. Now, when this was noised abroad, the multitude came together and were confounded, because that every man heard them speak in his own language. And they were all amazed, saying to one another, "Behold, are not all these which speak Galileans?" So there are your 11 other apostles, every one known to be a Galilean. Well, as I reminded you, the prophet Jeremiah, way back a little before 600 B.C., gave them that warning. "O ye children of Benjamin, gather yourselves to flee out of the midst of Jerusalem, for calamity appears out of the north and great destruction." Jesus Christ gave them another specific warning, and the fact that the Benjamites were by this time practically all Christians made his warning effective. No Jew was going to believe anything that Jesus Christ said, so he could safely give this warning without sparing any of the Jews. But the Christians believed him, and he saved their lives by it. It's in the 21st chapter of Luke, verse 20. You remember that the disciples had been commenting with some awe upon the magnificence of the great stone temple that Herod had built. And Jesus said, "Well, the time is coming when there won't be one stone of this left upon another." And the disciples said, "Well, what will be the sign of this? Or when will this be, rather? And what is the sign of thy coming, the end of this age?" So he told them, first of all, he answered their first question, "When is this going to be, if the temple will be torn down?" He said, "When ye shall see Jerusalem compassed," that is, encircled, "with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh." And he went on to give them then the answer to their second question, what would be the signs of his return. The historian Josephus gives us in detail the fulfillment of this. Josephus, Wars of the Jews, Book 4, Chapter 9, 9 through 11, and Book 5, first several chapters. Vespasian, the father of Titus, was the Roman general in command of the Roman armies in Palestine. And the Romans by this time were fed up with the rascality of these Jews, and they determined to put an end to it. So Vespasian got his army together and marching through the country, first clearing up the rest of the country where the little villages weren't able to make any particular resistance. And of course the Jews fled before him out of their villages into the great fortified city of Jerusalem. So, in the year 68 A.D., Vespasian swept the country with his army and finally came to Jerusalem, much too well fortified to simply take by storm. So he put his army around it to start a siege and starve them out. Josephus tells about it. "And now the war, having gone through all the mountainous country and all the plain country also, those that were at Jerusalem were deprived of the liberty of going out of the city. For, as to such as had a mind to desert, they were watched by the zealots. And as to such as were not yet on the side of the Romans, their army kept them in by encompassing the city round about on all sides." Well, here were some Benjamites, of course, cooped up in Jerusalem with the rest of them. But Nero, the Roman emperor, died. And by this time, the Roman armies were making and unmaking emperors. Now, Vespasian actually had a better right to the throne than any of those that were on hand to claim it. He was at least as near related in the royal family, and certainly he had the ability which the others had not shown. So the army told Vespasian, look, we don't want some incompetent fool back there made emperor. You go back to Rome and get this thing settled. The army back there will certainly rally to your support and they'll make you emperor. So he did so. Josephus tells this in the latter part of book 4. He pulled his armies out of the siege of Jerusalem, went back to the seacoast, and himself took ship for Rome. Now, remember, no Jew was willing to believe Christ's warning. The Christians, which means the handful of true Judahites down in Judah, and the Benjamites from Galilee, they said, just exactly what Christ warned us of. And so they fled. Because the Roman armies being withdrawn, anybody could go in or out of the city as he pleased. The next year, A.D. 69, Vespasian's son Titus, now in command of the Roman armies, resumed the siege, which lasted about a year. The city became, first of all, their forces were decimated from inside. They had taken in the Edomites, who had come there to help defend it. And then they had their own faction of the Zealots, and these became nothing more than bandits, not only killing anybody they suspected of not wanting to follow their political plans, but also killing anybody they suspected of having something worth stealing. Then pestilence broke out among them, and famine, and over 1 million people died in the siege. So Titus finally took the city and dragged the rest of them, the survivors, off to slavery or drove them out of the country. Well, the Benjamites, having taken the hint and gotten out, they fled across the Jordan River through the kingdom of Herod Agrippa on north into Asia Minor, what today is Turkey. Now, where to go? They couldn't go into Africa. They couldn't go to Greece or Italy, France, nor Spain. Those were all parts of the Roman Empire, and they would undoubtedly be arrested and sold into slavery as being fugitive rebel Jews. Some of them stayed put in the northern part of Asia Minor along the Black Sea coast in Cappadocia and a little area in there called Galatia. St. Paul's epistle to the Galatians was not written to those who were in Asia Minor. Galatia is the Greek form of Gaul, and it was written to the Christians who were in Gaul, which today is France. But anyway, there was a dinky little territory down in Asia Minor, also called Galatia. A few of them stayed there. Now, if they were going to leave, Scandinavia, Northern Britain, and Ireland were the only places that they could, well, or Germany, of course, that they could flee to for refuge, which were outside the Roman Empire. Those who stayed in Cappadocia in Asia Minor remained there until the year 267 A.D. The Goths sent a powerful army in there in a raid at that time, and they carried off the Christians into Europe. Now, those Benjamite Christians they picked up there were settled among the Dacian Goths in the Danube Valley and became Christian missionaries. Now, that was 287 A.D. And within the next half century, more than half of the Goths had already been converted to Christianity by these Benjamite missionaries. When the kingdom originally broke up into Israel and Judah, you remember God said that he was going to leave one extra tribe to the house of David, that they might always have a light before them. He left them the tribe of Benjamin. And the destiny of Benjamin from then on was to be the light bearers, and you can see how they did it. Trying in vain to furnish a good influence upon the southern kingdom, David was a reasonably good king. Solomon began as such. They had one other, Hezekiah. And for the rest, they were as fine a collection of scoundrels as you could find unhung. So the house of David didn't live up to the expectations. The tribe of Benjamin were the light carriers in Christ's time when they furnished most of his converts and 11 of his apostles. Now they were becoming the light carriers, converting the Goths, the people of Scythian Israel in Europe. We do know that they eventually arrived in Scandinavia and from there scattered somewhat. Now you run across people who like to show off some mock learning and tell you they can identify all 12 of the tribes today, and it's pure imagination. You can, I would say with substantial certainty, identify the tribe of Benjamin and the tribe of Dan. You've got good reason for identifying the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, and beyond that, you go into a field of pure guesswork. You remember this prediction about Benjamin was, he shall raven as a wolf. And they took the wolf as their emblem. The banner of Benjamin had a wolf on it. And you can trace them by that. If you see a band of troops marching today carrying the American flag and wearing the American Army uniform, you have pretty good reason to believe they're American soldiers. And when you find the people who are part of the Israel migration and carrying a banner which was not the flag of any of the other tribes, you've got pretty good reason for believing that thereby you trace the tribe of Benjamin, who did have that for their flag. Early records show that from their place in Asia Minor, right on the southern seashore of the Black Sea, quite a number of them sailed by ship, went through the Mediterranean, out the Straits of Gibraltar, on up the west coast of Europe, and landed in Scandinavia. They settled along the fjords of the North Sea coast of Norway. They were even then carrying the wolf banner. That was the quickest, the easiest route, and part of them went there. Part came with the Israel migration up the Danube Valley and across Germany to the Baltic Sea. The leader of one great part of that migration to Scandinavia was Odin. He was later deified among the Scandinavians as Odin. Among the Germans, they changed the name a little bit and made it Wodin or Wotan. But he is a very definite historical character, not mythology at all. He was their leader. He took them from, what is now extreme southwestern Russia, on up the Danube Valley, across Germany to the shores of the Baltic, and on across into Sweden. And incidentally, the genealogy of the family of George Washington has been traced, and Odin is one of his ancestors. Also, he is an ancestor of a good many of the European kings. On the march, he appears to have been a combination Moses and Aaron. He was their military leader, their judge, their lawmaker. And again, he served as high priest, assisted by 12 assistant priests. He made his final home in Sweden, and there he died. Thor, by the way, who also was deified as the god of thunder and of justice, was another historical character on that march, and probably a son of Odin, anyway, a close relative, and probably a son. The people that he led, they called themselves the Asar, which may have been simply what the southern tribes would have called Asher. You remember, one of the 12 tribes. Anyway, history records they were big men, blonde and blue-eyed, and terrible warriors. Their Norse runic writing shows that their language was Aryan, derived from the Phoenician, and the Phoenician was the language of ancient Israel. What passes for Hebrew, written Hebrew today, was unknown by any man on earth prior to the Babylonian captivity. It appears that they attempted to more or less copy the appearance of the cuneiform writing used by the Babylonians. But because specimens of it have been found of ancient date, it is known that the written Hebrew before the deportation used what has been called the Phoenician alphabet, and which is very, very ancient. You know, you're told that most of our European languages are descended from the Sanskrit, but the fact is that the Phoenician is the earlier language from which the Sanskrit was derived, and it very probably is the language that the Adamites brought when they began migrating out of the place in Western Asia to which Adam went when he was driven out of the Garden of Eden. There's difficulty in getting complete enough records on some of these things because you had nobody for many centuries undertaking to keep a complete world history, and the historical records of each city that was conquered were pretty much lost.